Hi everyone, Benjamin here. You're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. Welcome to our first show of 2017, and thanks for joining us. In this month's episode, Anand Jagatia is travelling down to the deepest, darkest depths of the ocean. Now, this is a place that couldn't be more different to the land that we live on, and yet, even these environments are teeming with life. In particular, microbes. This edition of the podcast is about the weird and wonderful life that lives at the bottom of the oceans and about the scientists who study it.
I'm interested in understanding a lot of things about the ocean in terms of microbes in the ocean, so single cell bacteria and archaea. And I think underwater volcanoes, hydrothermal vents are a really interesting place to study them because most of the volcanism on our planet happens under the ocean. And this type of volcanism has been going on for billions of years in Earth's history. And microbes evolved billions of years ago. They were the first life form on our planet, and volcanoes were there too. They've been living there and evolving and adapting for billions of years. And I really think it holds a lot of clues to how our planet functions in the past and looking forward as things change. You know, when we're out here, we're pretty isolated from our everyday lives. I don't really have any chores. You know, my main job is to work in the lab, to get samples, to man the social media, and to participate. And so we're really able to focus on the science. And you know, it's a short, intense period of time. And, you know, I love the ocean. You know, my whole life I've wanted to study the sea. And, you know, this is it. So that's why I keep coming back.
That's deep sea microbiologist Julie Huber, aboard a research vessel in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, as part of an expedition to explore the life in the Mariana Backarc. Back on dry land, I spoke to Julie down the line from her office in the US.
I'm especially interested in studying life away from the sunlight. You know, up here in the surface world, we have a very sun-centric view of life with you know, plants and photosynthesis kind of driving our ecosystem. But in the really deep ocean, there's some really neat ecosystems that are driven by chemical energy, not sun energy. And that's mainly what I study.
Julie works at the Marine Biology Laboratory in Massachusetts, where she's trying to uncover more about the microbes that live right at the very bottom of the ocean and actually below the ocean floor itself.
It's a hard concept to convey and even picture in our minds because when we think of the ocean, we just think of the water, right? But 70% of our planet is covered in oceans, and at the bottom of the ocean is the seafloor. And that seafloor can either be rocks, bare rocks, and in some places those rocks are also covered in sediments, which you can kind of think of as like the soil of the ocean. And within those sediments and within those rocks, there is life, and it's almost exclusively microbial life. There's viruses, there's some other relatively small organisms, but there's this entire ecosystem beneath the seafloor that we know very, very little about. And I'm especially interested in the part of that ecosystem which is within the rocks. So when oceanic crust is formed at these underwater volcanoes that we often study, there's actually a lot of space in that rock. You can kind of think of it like a jar of marbles, where you can shake the jar of marbles and there's all these spaces in there. And there's fluid, there's seawater that moves through those rocks. And, you know, with that water comes energy for life. There's reactions that occur between the rocks and the water that'll, you know, create new energy sources, and those are the reactions and microbes I'm interested in.
So when you say that there are microbes living below the ocean floor, how deep are we talking?
Well, the deepest recorded microbial life is 2.5 kilometers beneath the seafloor. And that was in a relatively recent study that drilled into marine sediments very, very deep off the coast of Japan, actually. You know, oceanic crust is extremely deep, but we think most of the microbial life in the crust is probably confined to the upper kilometer. However, remember, we're talking beneath the seafloor. The deepest point in the ocean is 11 kilometers. So there's a lot of water just to get to the bottom. And, you know, I study some systems that are as shallow as a few hundred meters deep of water, and others that are, you know, 5 kilometers of water above the seafloor. So a huge range in depth.
It's amazing to think that there's this whole ecosystem living in this part of the planet that we don't really know much about. There's this phrase, isn't there, that we know more about the surface of the moon than we do about the bottom of the ocean.
Sure. And I think the analogy to space exploration is a really good one. You know, it's the reason we don't have great maps of our oceans is because it's hard to make a map when you have an ocean there. It's not like flying over the surface of Mars or the moon, right, where the land is there and you can take pictures. So that's one of the reasons that we don't have great maps of the ocean. You have to actually put vehicles into the water and get them pretty close to the seafloor to make those maps.
Can you give us a sense of what we do know about this environment then? What's it like down there?
So the environments that these microbes are living in beneath the seafloor can vary widely, just like we have in the oceans, right? You know, in the ocean water, you can have coral reefs, or you can have, you know, surface communities that see a lot of sunlight, or you can have parts of the ocean where there's very little sunlight, but they're still in the water. And it's similar at the bottom of the ocean. Some of these environments can be very, very cold, you know, cold ocean sediments, and they can be very low energy environments where there's not a lot of carbon, not a lot of nutrients. And then in other parts, particularly close to the continents, where you get a lot of sediment and inputs from land, you can have much higher energy environments. And one area of the ocean I'm particularly interested in is life at underwater volcanoes or deep sea hydrothermal vents. And in these environments, you actually create a lot of energy because of the chemical energy that's released by the volcanoes. And so there you have this really intimate connection between these very fundamental geologic processes on our planet and life kind of making a way by capturing that energy. But with that great energy comes some really exceptional challenges, which includes high temperatures, high pressures, sometimes, you know, toxic metals. You can get really wide ranges in pH from very, very acidic, you know, it's almost as acidic as battery acid in some cases, up to the other extreme, very alkaline conditions, pH 10 or 11. And so these microbes have, over billions of years, learned to adapt to a really wide range of conditions on our planet.
I'm going to ask you more about these microbial survival strategies in a minute. But just coming back to underwater volcanoes, I've heard that around 80% of all the volcanism on Earth actually happens underwater. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it's about 3/4 of the volcanism of our planet occurs underwater. And we just...
That's crazy.
Yeah, we don't see it, right? It's out of sight, out of mind, similar to the bottom of the ocean. But it makes sense if you think about how, you know, how much of our planet is covered in oceans, that the bulk of volcanism would actually be beneath the surface.
So what happens when one of these things erupts?
You know, the first time I witnessed one was, 8 years ago or so. And what I found really strange about it is, you know, I've seen these videos of Mount St. Helens erupting, or, you know, volcanoes in Italy erupting, and you see this huge, huge ash plume go up into the sky, and it all seems very, very big. On the seafloor, these features are very large. They're very large volcanoes, but, you know, the active sites that we've seen erupting are, you know, only a few hundred meters wide, probably. And because of the dampening effects of seawater, cold seawater under high pressure, you know, it feels very local. Using a remotely operated vehicle, we can sit there and watch this eruption within a few meters of it, which you can never do on land, right? All the footage we see on land, it's from a helicopter or from very far away. And because of seawater, you can get very, very close. And you do still see sort of this ashen cloud rise into the ocean, but instead of ash, what this really is, it's full of particulate minerals. You know, it's full of things like sulfur and pieces of basaltic glass. And in many cases, it's quite acidic. But these plumes that come out of these erupting volcanoes can actually travel thousands of kilometers across the ocean, and you can trace their chemical signal. So there is signatures of this large-scale volcanism. It's just visually not quite the same as what we have up on land.
Coming back to microbes, you've mentioned already that it's not just one homogeneous environment down in the bottom of the deep ocean. There are areas that are very cold and low energy, and then there are others that are very high energy, just like these underwater volcanoes. So what kind of microbes do we see living along this spectrum, and how do they manage to make a living?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of different adaptations. So at the high temperature, high energy end, right, the big challenge there is kind of keeping your DNA together so it doesn't melt, making it so that your DNA can make proteins and enzymes so your cells can function. So at the high temperature end, these microbes have adapted, you know, to have ways to basically keep their DNA really tightly coiled to protect it with, you know, thermostable enzymes and things like that. They use different amino acids in their proteins that are more stable at high temperature. They replicate really, really quickly. And in these hydrothermal vent environments, a lot of the microbes are geared towards autotrophy or fixing their own carbon. You know, I mentioned these environments are very far away from the sunlight. There's not a lot of organic carbon. And so they're taking CO2, which is in seawater and in these vent fluids, and they're fixing it into new biomass. And what they do is they combine that with something like eating hydrogen sulfide or eating hydrogen, eating iron, methane. And these are very common, actually, metabolic processes, you know, in lots of different environments on our planet. But at hydrothermal vents, they're also kind of up against this high temperature challenge. Kind of at the other end of the spectrum, in these really low organic, cold, slow environments, we're still trying to figure out in many cases how these microbes make a living. It looks like a lot of them are still surviving on the very little amount of organic carbon that rains down from the surface ocean. And there's some estimates that these cells maybe only divide every 100 or 1,000 years. So it's definitely like life in the slow lane, right? How is that possible? Like, how can a cell maintain itself without high replication, right? Or even reasonable replication, right? And there's some thoughts on other energy sources. They might be using radiolytic hydrogen, some forms of autotrophy that maybe we just haven't captured yet. So I think there's a lot of questions at both ends of how these organisms are making a living.
In other parts of the ocean, closer to the surface, we know that microbes play a very important role in the ecosystems within things like the carbon cycle. What do we know about the role of deep sea microbes to those ecosystems?
Right. So that's one of the things we're trying to get a handle on. And, you know, what it really comes down to is flux and trying to understand what is the impact of the activity of these organisms into the ocean, right? From the bottom of the ocean into the rest of the ocean. So as an example, we know that in the surface ocean, you know, something like 40 or 50% of the carbon dioxide fixed in our atmosphere happens in that surface ocean. And it's mainly by, you know, phytoplankton and single cell bacteria. And a lot of that carbon gets eaten right up there in the surface ocean. And what's left is left over gets exported into the deep ocean. A lot of that carbon gets eaten again once it comes into sediments. And that's by these heterotrophic bacteria that continue to consume it. But if you, at the same time, have other organisms in the deep ocean that are fixing carbon dioxide and creating new carbon, you know, how does that impact the balance of carbon in our ocean? And so that's just one example of, without a lot of data points, is really hard to constrain the flux. But you can also imagine, you know, with the iron cycle, if microbes are oxidizing iron out of rocks, that would really impact the amount of iron in our ocean. And iron is a super important nutrient for all primary producers in the ocean. So it's sort of trying to link what seem like sort of small-scale processes and put them into a larger framework to understand biogeochemical cycling in the ocean.
So to answer these questions then, and to work out exactly what is going on down there, you actually need to travel right down to the bottom of the ocean and explore. and collect samples and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sample intense field, right? So once or twice a year, we go to sea and we go to a lot of different places around the globe, really. We've worked in the Western Pacific, we've worked in the North Pacific, the Caribbean, the Mid-Atlantic. And, you know, there are different environments across this gradient with, you know, and the goal, though, is always understanding, you know, what microbes are here and how are they interacting with this local geochemical environment to make a living. And so we mount these expeditions. They're usually very multidisciplinary. So they're geologists and chemists and animal biologists and physicists aboard. And we have to use pretty advanced robotics to get to the bottom of the ocean. So a lot of the time we'll use a remotely operated vehicle, which is tethered back to the ship. So there's no people in the vehicle and it goes to the bottom and we're controlling it from the surface, a whole team of engineers, and collecting samples and running experiments once we get things back up on deck and then analyzing results when we get back to the lab on land. We also sometimes used submersibles with people in them. The most famous one in the United States is the Alvin. And so this is a vehicle that goes down with one pilot and two scientists, and you similar kind of operations, except that the vehicle is not connected to the ship at all. It's sort of on its own for the day to do science, bring samples back. A lot of what we do at sea is archiving samples for analyses back home, but we also run experiments to try to get to some of the things we've been talking about, like what are the rates of carbon fixation and things like that.
Have you managed to go down in one of these submersibles yourself?
I have. I've been down in Alvin a couple of times.
Yeah? What's it like?
It's amazing. It's very humbling. You know, you spend much of your life staring at least me, right? I've spent much of my life staring at either the surface of the ocean or the bottom of the ocean. You don't spend much time on the pass through. And as soon as you leave the surface, within 10 minutes or so, you lose almost all surface light. So just a couple hundred meters. And it's very dark. It's very quiet. We turn off all the lights and such to save power on the way down. And then around you, you start seeing all these blue lights flashing. And those are bioluminescent organisms in the ocean. And in the dark, that's how they communicate, is using light. And it takes a long time to get to the bottom. Well, I've been to about 2 kilometers or so, and, you know, it took just shy of 2 hours. And then it's amazing that you pass through all this dark space and you get to the bottom and you turn on your lights and there's these black smoke or chimneys gushing out, you know, 600 degree Fahrenheit vent fluid, and there's tube worms and there's thick microbial mats, and it's a really remarkable experience. It's hard to put it into words, but I mean, if I could do it once a week, I would. Not every day. It gets a little bit exhausting. It's not for, you know, if you're claustrophobic, it's not for you. It's very cold at the bottom of the ocean. And so, you know, you might be warm at the surface, but by the time you get to the bottom, you start having to put on a wool hat and wool socks and a thick blanket to keep warm while you're doing your work. But it's amazing.
Of course, there aren't many people who will ever get the opportunity to go down to the ocean floor and see these environments for themselves like you have. But they can do the next best thing, which is to watch some of the live video streams that you guys have captured during your expeditions.
Yeah, and I think this has been one of the best advances for ocean sciences in the last decade, is using the power of remotely operated vehicles to share our science with the world. You know, I have been down in Alvin a few times, but most of my work has involved ROVs in the last few years. And one of the most compelling reasons as a scientist is, even just on board, we all get to share in the experience of what we're doing on the seafloor, because we're all up on the ship and we can, you know, say, what do you think we're looking at? You know, and we can have conversations in real time as opposed to just a couple of people participating in the dive if you're using a manned submersible. But with this new telepresence technology, you know, we can stream it to millions of people. And you know, they love it. It's amazing. And it's really, really fun as a scientist to be able to share that part of our work. It's not super technical, right? It's just, look at this amazing stuff going on in our planet, right? Did you know that there are crabs living in pH 3 water and they eat each other? Like, I didn't know that until I just saw it 10 minutes ago. And I've been able to share that with all of you. And so I've found that to be a really wonderful advance that we've made in the last few years. And having organizations that are committed to it has been really important.
I guess using social media to post these kind of videos and live streams must massively increase your reach.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like underwater volcanoes in particular are kind of a gateway drug to STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics for people. You know, I have a lot of students who pass through my lab. They think they want to be maybe a doctor, let's say, a medical doctor. And after a summer of working in my lab, they decide, actually, you know what? I want to go into aeronautical engineering. Or, you know, I think maybe I want to, you know, be an environmental microbiologist who studies, you know, microbes in our drinking water or things like that. I think, you know, it really captures your imagination thinking about what is happening on our planet that's out of sight and out of mind. And so it's a wonderful tool to kind of suck people into science.
So Julie, what happens once you've got these samples? So you've traveled down, you've done your collections. What do you do with these goodies from the bottom of the ocean?
So out on the ship, as I mentioned, we archive a number of samples, but we also do a number of experiments. And then when we come back here, we are doing things like sequencing all of the genes from an individual sample. And the goal there is to figure out what microbes are present and what potential functions they are capable of, whether it's fixing carbon or oxidizing sulfur. And that's really to put together sort of a metabolic map of who is there and what they're capable of doing. And so we do that lab work, including all the DNA sequencing back here. Then we have a number of experiments that we've run at sea, but we don't know if they work till we get back and do a bunch of different analyses. We do things like look under the microscope, say, you know, did anything grow in these experiments? And if so, can we keep it growing in the laboratory? So kind of a cultivation approach to trying to keep microbes alive in the lab by replicating the conditions we think they live in on the seafloor. So that's just an example of a few things that we do.
Taking a bit of a step back from the nuts and bolts of just trying to work out who is there, so what microbial species are present and what they're doing, what are some of the bigger picture questions that your lab is trying to answer?
Well, you know, I would say my research operates in two modes. You know, one is very exploratory. Often there isn't a hypothesis. It's, you know, what is out there? Let's make a map. Let's get some samples. Let's find out what's going on. And in other cases, it's sites that we've been to a few times and we have specific hypotheses about who we think some of the key players are and trying to constrain their rates, their relationships, et cetera. But some of the big things I'm interested in are sort of, you know, what's the extent of the subsea floor biosphere? You know, we have some estimates of how many cells, for example, are in the oceans and the contribution that makes to primary biomass in our planet. We have very poorly constrained estimates for beneath the seafloor. You know, what is the ultimate fate of this new production of carbon in the deep ocean? How are the organisms in one side of the Pacific Ocean related to those on the other side or in the Atlantic Ocean? You know, things like that. And really, when I look at these systems, one of the things that gets me really excited is thinking about how, you know, volcanism has been happening on our planet for 4 billion years. And these organisms have probably been around for at least 3.5 billion, if not longer. And so these organisms are really good at figuring out how to make a living in these places. And I love thinking about how we could be studying relics of really ancient life. And they're still here. They're still doing it. And I think that's really fascinating.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for talking to us. It's been a pleasure. Have you got any parting thoughts before we go?
Next time you're at the beach, think about the fact that that water at one point in time probably touched the bottom of the ocean, might have even traveled through the subsea floor, and it's, you know, it's all connected. It's It's a pretty remarkable place when you think about the ocean on a whole.
And I'm there talking to Julie Huber from the Marine Biological Laboratory in Massachusetts. Now, that's almost it for this episode, but before I go, I'd like to tell you that registration is now open for the Microbiology Society Annual Conference 2017. It is going to be our biggest and our best conference yet, and it will be held in Edinburgh from the 2nd of April. Now, you can still grab an early bird registration rate until the 3rd of March, so if you want to get a discount, visit the events page on our website, which is microbiologysociety.org. Listen out for us again next month when we'll be back with another show. But until then, don't forget to follow the Society on Twitter, which is at MicrobioSoc, and on Facebook. Our show was edited and produced by Anand Jagatia. I've been Dr. Benjamin Thompson. See you all next time.